This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 20. Dzogchen's intimacy, a pointer. The profound talk entering into noumenon decides three and weeds out four. The great way to the capital goes seven ways across and eight ways up and down. Suddenly, if you can open your mouth and explain fully, take steps and walk. Then you can hang your bowl and bag up high and break your staff. But tell me, who is such a person? The main case. Master Dzogchen asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dzogchen said, "What is the purpose of your pilgrimage?" Fayan said, "I don't know." Dzogchen said, "Not knowing is most intimate." The verse. Now having studied to the full, it's like before. Having shed entirely the finest thread, he reaches not knowing. Let it be short, let it be long. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. The abundance of scarcity of the house is used according to the abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, he goes where his feet take him. The purpose of 10 years' pilgrimage. Clearly, he turned his back on one pair of eyebrows. So, good morning. And good morning to you at home or wherever you are. Fayan was Dzogchen's student, and they were talking ninth. Early 10th century, China. And this koan is the dialogue in the transmission of the lamp of how Dzogchen or Fayan came to realization with Dzogchen. In the record of Fayan, there's a little bit more detail. Fayan was on a pilgrimage with some other Dharma friends, and they got stopped by a snowstorm and took shelter in Dzogchen's temple. They stayed there for a couple of days until the snow stopped and cleared a little bit. And as they were leaving, Dzogchen walked them out to the front gate to see them off. And as they got to the gate, Dzogchen said, "I've been listening to you pilgrims talk about the three realms are mind, and that all dharmas are consciousness." And then Dzogchen pointed to a large rock and he said, "Is this rock inside or outside of your mind?" And Fayan said, "It's inside." And Dzogchen said, "What a heavy thing to be carrying around on a pilgrimage." And Fayan was stopped by that. So the others left, and he picked up his things and went back into the temple with Dzogchen and decided to study with him and succeeded him. "Where are you going?" he asks him. Fayan says, "Around on pilgrimage." "Where are you going?" The footnote to that says, why put him into a frame? The search is, in a sense, one of the oldest stories of humanity. You see it in every culture, in every tradition. It's sort of the quintessentially human tale, the journey. Leaving home, setting out, searching. And as essential as that is in Buddha Dharma, there's also many times when teachers will say that in taking that first step already, you're moving away. And yet without taking that step, there is no journey. And so in a very real sense, the whole of that journey is, what is the journey? What is it? What are we seeking? Where are we going? Where will we find it? What will we find? That journey really holds the seeds of the whole of our lives. Some people will say, well, everyone is on a journey. I mean, in a sense, that's true, particularly if you believe in rebirth and that every human being is ultimately seeking peace and freedom. And then in each lifetime, we are on that path, although sometimes those lifetimes set us back quite a bit. Because we're not on the path in a skillful way. But I think we also have to allow for the possibility that in this lifetime, there are people who are not on a path. To be on a path means to be seeking. To be seeking means to have questioned, to be inquiring, to want to understand something, to be seeking something, to in some way have already left home, to in some way have already found the place where we begin, not a place to remain in. And so what is it that stirs us? Why don't we just carry on as before, follow the rules, the examples of those around us? If we're seeking an adventure, if that's what the journey's about, if we're seeking because we've been encouraged to do this, this would be good for you. If we're on the journey because we think it's something we should do, somebody once came to me and who had started coming here, and they actually produced a checklist. And they said, you know, I've been working really hard in my life. I've taken care of relationship. I've taken care of career. So this is time to start taking care of my spiritual life. If it's something we're doing because other people are doing it, we don't want to feel like the odd one out within our particular group. Then as it says in the pointer, maybe we should just go ahead and break our walking staff, hang up our shoes, and save ourselves a whole heap of trouble. When it's not a choice, and it's that you choose every day, then maybe we have a reason to travel. You know, it's like being in a long hallway with just, you know, virtually an infinite number of doors. As we're walking down that hallway, if every one of those doors is open and we stop to look in and check it out and spend some time there, wander around, but in a sense, if in that hallway, we see the doors. Maybe they're open. Maybe some of them we pause, but there's a clear sense of where you need to be headed. Something different is going on. You know, in the Lotus Sutra, there's the famous parable of the burning house. So there's a father who has several children, and the house is falling apart. But the children are happy there. A fire breaks out. And the father is trying to figure out how to get the children out of the house. So obviously he goes to them and says, there's a fire. We got to get out. And they're like, no. No, we're playing. We're having a good time. We don't want to leave. So he tries to get them to leave. But as it says in the sutra, they're inside enjoying themselves and playing games. They're unaware, unknowing, without any sense of alarm or fear. The fire is closing in, suffering and pain threaten them, and yet their minds have no sense of peril. They don't think of trying to escape. The parent says, you must come out at once. The sutra says, but they were absorbed in their games, unwilling to hear, unwilling to see, register the alarm. They did not understand what the fire was. They did not understand what the house was. They did not understand what the danger was. In a sense, that's why the path is a solitary affair. Right? When most of the world, it seems, is in that house, absorbed in the games, and when new games keep appearing every minute, and they keep getting better and better, it's easy, in a sense, to go with the numbers. To stand up and to walk in a different direction takes a certain degree of courage or desperation or clarity. Use whatever you have. What is the purpose of your pilgrimage? I was seeing where an author who had written about journeying and said that the journey requires a calling. A calling. A calling towards something, away from wherever we find ourselves. A separation. That by its very nature, the author said that a pilgrimage undoes certainty. In a sense, threatens the status quo. And then the journey itself. And within that journey, there has to be contemplation, reflection, examination, some kind of engagement. And then there's an encounter, the author said, with what we're seeking. And then there's returning. At the culmination, the pilgrim returns home only to discover that the meaning they sought lies in the familiarity of their everyday world. They realize that all along, they never needed to take a step. Now, this wasn't a Buddhist author. So this sort of, you know, presentation of the journey we find again and again and again. It's quite interesting. In a way, it shouldn't be surprising if it's a universal trait, if it's a universal experience of human beings. But I would say that in that calling, there's already separation. Already there's a sense of somehow being apart, somehow being outside of something. And that in that sense, already the journey has begun. You know, we may all have a sense of the time or the moment when we first encountered the Dharma or we first actively stepped forward, but then in reflection later, we must be able to see how that moment was the culmination of, and only a momentary culmination, of much that had preceded. The journey had begun before we knew it. Which means that already there had been some measure of contemplation, some measure of reflection, of wondering. Again, even though we may have been little aware of it. And in that sense, from a Buddhist perspective, already we've encountered the very thing that we're seeking. How could we seek Buddha mind if Buddha mind was not already present and active and poking? When a house is burning and we want to put out the flames, the natural thing would be to aim the extinguisher to the flames. That's where the heat seems to be coming from. That's where the danger is. But a more skilled person will aim it at the base of the fire. It's fuel. A bodhisattva will turn to that house, to that fire, to the danger, and say, what is this? They will ask, what is mind? What is arising in this moment? What is the danger? They know that to run out of the house may be skillful in that moment, and it will also be a temporary reprieve. It's difficult to stop and examine and be mindful when we're in the midst of danger. And that's why it's so important to practice mindfulness, patience, awareness, courage in smaller fires, in less significant dangers. What is the purpose of your pilgrimage? Freedom, enlightenment, liberation, understanding? Master Dijang once said, if you want to come face to face with the essential mystery of our lives, of this Dharma, here it is. There is no other special thing. It's just what you say and do. You come here to this place of training, and speak words like tranquility, reality, perfection, or constancy. Worthy practitioners, what is it that you call tranquil, real? What is it that's perfect or constant? If you are on a pilgrimage, you must test the principle of what I'm saying. Examine closely. Let's be open about it. You must test the print. You must. He said, let's be open about it. You've stored up a bunch of sounds, forms, names, concepts inside your mind. You say, I can do this. I'm not very good at this. He said, all of that you're remembering and holding on to is just sounds and forms. How will you find your way through it? To know truly, it's what you say and do. I remember when I would hear my teacher say that in my early years, the words seemed so simple. And I would reflect them back upon myself. It's what I'm saying and doing. And it was so clear to me, I do not understand what you're saying. I hear the words. I understand the meaning. But when I reflect on that in terms of my present understanding of what I am saying and doing, I realize there is something more. That's what Dijang is saying. That's what we need to be examining. What is the purpose of your pilgrimage? Dijang says. Fayan says, I don't know. Dijang said, nope, not knowing is most intimate. You know, I think one of the things that's particularly difficult in our practice of the Dharma today is that the Dharma is pointing to the fundamental. And it's calling to us to do what we must do to enter into and test and examine and find our liberation within that fundamental, that deepest yearning. Meanwhile, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Everyday stuff. Stuff that may only happen once in a lifetime, once in a history, never before stuff, all kinds of stuff going on. And there can seem like a unbridgeable gap between those two. Right? A person might reasonably and legitimately say, I need something now, today, to make sense of all this stuff that's going on in the world. I want to understand it. I want to be able to respond. I want to be able to help and serve. And so from the very beginning, we are given tools, practices, teachings. In a sense, we're given pretty much the whole thing. Nothing really hidden here. But even though we're given the whole thing, so much of it seems locked away. You know, it's like we're given a chest full of all the treasures. They're all there, and we open it up, and we don't see anything, or we see a few little stones or some dust, you know. And all of the teachers since the time of the Buddha, Dijang, Fayan, they say, no, it's there, just look. And I say, I am looking. There's nothing there. And they say, keep looking. Look closer. Learn how to look. Don't just use your eyes. If you want to see, you have to use the whole of your being. Dongshan said you have to look with your ears, your toes, your spleen. And unfortunately, we just can't will ourselves to do that in a minute. We just can't. No matter how much you want to, no matter how sincere you are. It takes time. And so to do that work, do this work while, so that we gain access to all that we actually need and are seeking and yearning for. And to do that while the house is burning is a tremendous undertaking. What kind of faith does that require? To trust that process. And to not wait and say, well, the fire's going to have to burn on its own for a while I do this very important work. Uh-uh. How do I do this while the house is burning? And we attend to the burning house. All the practice is taking place within this intimacy. All the practice is ultimately taking place within, I don't know. Why then is it so difficult to realize it? I mean, just think of the Buddha, by his own words, in the moments of his own enlightenment. At Bodh Gaya, there's the place where he sat under the tree. And now, many generations of trees later. But you can sit pretty close. Under the same sky, in the same space, seeing the same, well, I don't know what it looked like back then. And after his realization, it said that he remained and stood or sat for some days, 7 days or something, looking back at that tree, taking in, absorbing all that he had just realized. Just think of this most profound understanding going into the very belly of the whole universe and seeing it illuminated. And in the midst of that, having grave doubts about whether it made sense, whether it was reasonable to try and teach. Not because he didn't want to, not because he didn't want anyone, everyone, to be so liberated, but because he understood this is not going to be easy. How many will actually be willing to step in? I don't know. Fayan said. Not knowing in a society that runs on knowing, that is suspicious and wary and even disinterested, antagonistic towards not knowing. You know, so the evidence of, you know, our scientists and business folk, technology folk as heroes, and, you know, don't get me wrong, the best of them do immensely important work. But meanwhile, our musicians and painters and bards and storytellers and religious are trying to eke out existence in the shadows. Because the essence of what they're offering can't be measured. I don't know, Fayan said. There is not having information, not knowing. There's not understanding a concept. I don't know. There's forgetting something you once knew. There's being uncertain. There are many kinds of not knowing. But all of those are struggling to know within knowing. We're within knowing. Knowing here means being in a frame. Just not quite understanding the frame, trying to clarify the frame, trying to make it more understandable, more knowable, more functional. Not knowing is free of all of that. Nanquan said, the way is not in knowing or in not knowing. Knowing is false consciousness. False consciousness is really our karmic consciousness. False in that sense doesn't mean it's wrong or it's bad. False in the sense of it's not clearly showing or illuminating reality. Being false means that it's dependent upon, it's a construction, which means it's going to come apart. It also means it takes constant effort to keep it together. And so racism is false consciousness, patriarchy, nationalism, xenophobia, homophobia are all forms of false consciousness, constructed. Because they are constructed, they are constantly in a state of coming apart. But they have to, and so there's constant effort to try and keep them going. That's what systems do. It's what individuals do. The work of our time is not only to allow them to come apart, but expedite that coming apart. I was listening to a reading, an interview, conversation between Sharon Salzberg and Reverend Kyoto Angel Williams. And Sharon was both Buddhist teachers. Sharon was talking about a conversation she had many years ago with a person very, very involved in the civil rights. And she asked him, how do you stay alive? How do you keep resilient and keep your spirits up? And he said, I look at the mountains. I sit and I look at the mountains. And then she said they kept talking and talking, and they started talking about loving kindness. And this civil rights leader that she was talking to said, Martin Luther King used to say to me all the time, you've got to love everybody. And I used to say to him, no, I don't. I only have to love the people worth loving. And King would laugh and laugh and say, no, you've got to love everybody. Then Kyoto Williams said, you don't have to like anyone at all. People always tease me about this. I hardly like anyone, but I love everyone. And that is possible. In fact, it's the very thing that bridges the spiritual life and the activist life. She said, when I first came to Buddhist practice, I thought that when people were at the pinnacle, with the sort of height of their practice, their understanding, that they would see the need to respond to the problems of the world. Isn't that what would happen naturally, inevitably? And she said, but that wasn't my experience. And so she switched her focus to the activists. They were trying to change the world. So she thought, if I support them with meditation, teachings, awareness practice, then they could do it more effectively. She said, in social justice work, the only option is to love everyone. This is the bodhisattva path. Otherwise, there's no real path to change, because the path and what we're trying to accomplish is the same. It's the same. The search, how we search, and what we find is the same. That's why we have to be very diligent and very attentive and meticulous about how we practice. This is it. If we're sloppy in practice, the consequences of our practice are going to be sloppy. If our practice is divided up into compartments, this counts, this doesn't, these matter, these don't, then the fruits of our practice are going to be divided. And so she says, otherwise there is no path to change if it isn't based in love. And so she said, what I ran into in working with activists, of course, was that they pretty much didn't love anybody. So love is what I focused on, because in social justice work, the only option is to love everyone. Otherwise, there's no path to change. Whether we're leaning towards a spiritual community or an activist community, what we need is the combination or the merging, the unifying of a mind that wants to change the world and a mind that is steady, clear-seeing, and seeks change from a place of love rather than a place of anger. And so there need to be places within which people can gather, in which there's a very strong emphasis on that activism with a strong practice element. And there need to be places where there's a very strong practice element that's integrated with changing the world. Do you understand? Practice is happening in many different places. And different places and different traditions and different pathways give us different ways of bringing ourselves to it, different ways of emphasizing different aspects of the same work. And we, based on our inclinations, temperamentally throughout our lives, or perhaps just where we are at this moment, may be drawn to or need different kinds of places to develop what we need to develop. And she says, it's important not to get stuck in our own views. Even if you think yours is the right way, there's always someone else who has another way. Then you're in an irreconcilable conflict that doesn't get resolved except, I think, through love. And so then the question comes back to, what are we talking about? What is this love? Love is just a big, fat word. It's a sound that we make in our mouth. And when we make it, all kinds of thoughts and ideas come up. And that doesn't mean it's wrong. But those ideas and concepts will also limit us. What is it to just see, just hear? The commentary says, when people hear it said that not knowing is intimacy, and that this is where Fayon was enlightened, they immediately run over to just not knowing. Just don't know. I get it. Just don't understand. Just this is it. And then the commentary goes on to say, they hardly realize that a phrase of the ancients covers everywhere like the sky, supports everywhere like the earth. So while we've rushed over and taken this up, oh, I get it, it's just don't know. The sky has become like a postage stamp. The ground has become like a grain of sand. And all the while, we don't understand how large that phrase is. Commentary says, if not knowing is most intimate, then what about another master who said the one word knowing is the gate of myriad wonders? Just affirm completely when affirming, but don't settle down in affirmation. When denying, totally deny, but don't settle down in denial. Passing through all of the ranks, all of the levels, all of the notions. Don't die within a phrase. Master Dogen said about this koan, said, if I had been there, I would have responded to Dijang saying, is not knowing most intimate or is knowing most intimate? I completely leave the greatest intimacy to intimacy itself. But now I ask Dijang, what is this intimacy? What are we talking about? When we stop talking, then what is it? I completely leave the greatest intimacy to intimacy itself. Leave I don't know to I don't know. We can practice letting go of knowing. That's what we do in every moment. When something comes up that frames you, yourself, identity, desire, practice, liberation. When something that comes up that frames the world, oppression, disruption, earth, climate crisis. These words that we must use. But what are we talking about? Because there are conversations being had all over the place that are using the same words and are having different conversations, meaning different things. Dharma practice is to take us to the fundamental. To go beyond the meaning of the words themselves and realize the heart of being. Because then, in that conversation, in those conversations, when we hear those words being used, now we know they are not things. They have no inherent anything. They are being used in that moment by ourselves or by different people in different ways that mean different things for different purposes, having different consequences. And some are being used very skillfully and some are not. And more we're able to see that. And when we see the emotions arise as we're using those words and as we see the reactions to those emotions by the people who are having the emotions, by people who are experiencing those emotions, on the other side, we're able to see those emotions as having no inherent existence, no inherent quality, as making sense in that moment to the person who is having that emotion. It makes sense. That in those moments, it affirms their view. It affirms our view. Now we can see. And seeing, we don't get so caught. Yesterday I was doing a retreat for, well, the residents were doing a solitary retreat. I was doing a retreat for outside, for other Sangha members. And called Being Okay with Not Being Okay. And I said at the very outset that I wanted to make sure everybody was clear that this had nothing to do with striving towards a kind of passivity or complacency with everything that is not okay and is not okay, and just being okay with that. I said that is not at all what we're going to talk about, what we're working on, and that has nothing to do with Buddhist practice. but has everything to do with how do we meet each and every moment. Because that's where it's happening. That's the only show in town. That's the only world there is right now, and right now, and right now. An old master said, I follow the stream to its source and then sit and see where the clouds rise. To study those clouds. Where do they arise? What are they? Because then we can navigate a world with clouds. Having studied to the full, it's like before. Practice, realization, enlightenment, awakening, liberation changes nothing. We could say that it changes our view. Certainly, we see our lives changing. That should be true. But what is not changing? Having shed entirely the finest thread, finally we reach not knowing. That's what we can practice, shedding all of our threads. We can practice letting go of not knowing. You can't practice, you can't create not knowing. It's not a thing. You can't bring yourself to it. And yet, everything depends on it. Whether we realize it or not, everything depends on it. Let it be short, let it be long, stop cutting and patching. He's saying to stop trying to finesse. You know, it's like while the house is burning, we're rewiring. We're lighting a fire in the fireplace. Stop cutting and patching. Going along with the high, along with the low, it levels itself. Going along, again, is not being passive. It's not just saying, you know, I heard some people saying at the rally, in the Trump rally in Tulsa, looking at the news, if I get the coronavirus and die, then I get the virus and die. And I thought, I'd like to come back. I hope you don't get it. If you do, I wonder how you will feel then. If you do and you infect others, how will you feel then? Will just going along with the flow seem like a good idea? Will that make sense to you now? Will you speak with the same casualness about your own life? That's what not intimacy does. It creates fictional worlds in our lives where we are fictional people with fictional courage or fictional disinterest. And then suddenly, we can't breathe. You're the one. I feel the heat. I'm the one. Now, how is it? And it does level itself. What is the unity? Where do we find non-differentiation within the differentiation? All things are equal and one essence within all of the multitude of our differences. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. This is how. Use what you've got. If you're in a time of abundance, use the abundance. If you're in a time of scarcity, use the scarcity. Become a master traveler. Isn't that what we need to do right now? Use what we have. I remember years ago watching Lord of the Rings, A Great Journey. And was it Frodo? Was he the guy with the ring? So he was sitting there and kind of, as I recall, this is how I'm going to tell the story. Because this is how I remember it. Because this is how it impacted me. Feeling kind of sorry for himself. That he was the one with the ring. And that his one precious life had to be in the time of this damn ring. And all the trouble it was causing. And why me? And Gandalf said, because this is the time that we have. Because this is the time in which you were born. Indeed. So I'd like to end with a poem by Xingang. She's the Chinese Buddhist nun that I spoke of a couple of weeks ago about her Buddha bowl, her Oryoki bowl, her alms bowl. How very elegant it is, with not even a single leak or hole. When thirsty, I drink. When hungry, I eat, leaving not a crumb. I understand that once washed, nothing more need be done. Yet how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it? I understand that once washed, having eaten, nothing more need be done. Now, as before, complete. Now, having come this far, I forget. When Fayan started out on his pilgrimage, I will bet you he knew why he was on his pilgrimage. He had a very clear sense of what he was, of what his purpose was. But because of that, at this ripe moment, he answered, I don't know. I don't know, said, I don't know. It wasn't Fayan. Nothing more needs to be done. Yet, how many of us insist on attaching a handle? Dharma practice is, from my perspective, or any genuine practice which takes us into the heart of being, and sees that as one, as inseparable from being a benefit in the world. Gives us the greatest challenge, the greatest tension, how to care so deeply about this life, about this world, about people and creatures and things. How to care so deeply. And to be a benefit. And to do that with our eyes wide open and bright and our hearts open and joyful. Which does not mean always happy. But it means not wanting to be in any other time. To be glad that I am in this time because I have the chance of doing something when it's needed. Even though I am just one person and my efforts seem so small. And my understanding so insufficient to the task. I use what I have. My scarcity, my abundance. That's a life of no regret, I think. That's a good life.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma Talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.